Well, I was hoping for a few more people. What a crowd. Thank you so much for coming. Good to see you, and welcome to the new people who are scattered about here and there. So I think, as almost everyone here knows, except for maybe some of the new people, we are in the middle now of our practice period, a time when we collectively intensify our practice in a sense, kind of modeling at the time of the Buddha, when the Buddha, during the rainy season, would gather with the monks and the nuns, and they would intensify their practice, a time to discuss, study, practice together. And then at the end of the rainy season, they would again disperse and wander, which was one of the key practices at that time, rather than everyone living together in one place. So can everyone hear me in the far back? I'm projecting. So the theme that we're looking at is suffering and resilience, kind of life in the samsaric world, this world where things don't go the way we want them to. You ever notice that? They just don't go the way I want them to. So we'll be doing a series of talks, both Sundays and Wednesdays. And tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about groundlessness. Groundlessness. I'll define that in just a little bit here. So Kate and I often go for what we call walk runs. Kate walks and I run, usually along paths where we live, through the woods. Kate and I live kind of outside Mission, the town of Mission. And it's one of the great pleasures about living outside of Vancouver is there's lots of woods and wild areas to visit. So these past weeks, I've noticed on our walk runs the kind of really rapid change of the foliage. The flat, dry, scale-like needles of the cedar have fallen because so many of them turn brown during this long, dry summer. And along with them, the maple leaves as well, kind of bright yellow, falling rapidly these days. And the grasses and sedges have turned brown. And the woods are generally pretty quiet, except for the calls of jays, crows, and ravens. Most of the songbirds have headed south. So change is in the air, but change is always in the air. If you look closely at your own life, though, don't you see a kind of almost seasonal pattern of beginnings and endings, sometimes subtle and sometimes very pronounced? I think in part because I have taught for most of my adult life in colleges and universities, September is the time of new beginnings. There's fresh tasks to be done, and commitment and energy are called for. And summer, for me, on the other hand, is kind of less focused. More relaxed, there's fewer obligations that I need to attend to. So is there a seasonal pattern in your life? I think for many of us, change has become part of our seasonal pattern, whatever that may be. Fall, a time to start new activities, perhaps. Maybe begin the diet or the new art class. New Year's is often another time we decide to make changes in our lives. But maybe for you it's spring or it's summer. I think each person is probably a little bit unique in this way. It is important to honor the desire to make changes in one's life when that desire arises. You know, we need to look at it and not just dismiss it. But it's also important to ask, Does this call for change come from a surface place of the ego? Or is it really coming from somewhere deeper? I think we all recognize that to grow and develop is healthy. Just as plants drop off the old leaves preparing for winter, we too sometimes need to let go of parts of ourselves that are no longer wholesome or healthy. And we may need, like the plants, sometimes to simply lie fallow to prepare for what will emerge from our life. However, this kind of relenting self-improvement change is kind of a theme of our age, right? The pressure to make ourselves better, stronger, more talented, it really comes from all directions, giving birth to the impulse to make change because there is something unbearable about the present. And the Buddha, throughout his teachings, warned that many impulses to make small or great changes are born from greed, hate, and delusion. And for example, perhaps unhappy with your job, not liking how you're treated or how you feel at the workplace, the impulse to quit may arise. And if that motivation is just to escape, to avoid dealing with others or speaking truth really clearly to the power, then I think finding a new situation will seldom help. And I think that's true of relationships as well. Much easier to leave than face the challenge of deepening intimacy. Because just leaving will not help you learn to create a healthy relationship or develop the skills necessary to remain upright when things get challenging. And yet, as we all know, on the other hand, to remain locked into an unhealthy environment, subject to demeaning or abusive behavior, or locked in a relationship that is not allowing one to grow and change, those kind of things may give rise to actually a wholesome motivation to leave and to make changes. The Buddha clearly advised a careful reflection on one's own motivation for a change. And I could add, perhaps, motivation to not change. Sometimes we kind of grasp at change because we cannot tolerate where we are. The present moment is too painful, too limited, too unpleasant and dark. The change that we're looking for may be, we think, to find a way to fix ourselves or to fix our partner. It's probably our partner anyway. Fix our partner. Or move to a different place, hoping that a new place will give us stability in some way and comfort that we seek. So I think that's kind of like one pole of our life, the craving for change from the present. And as we all know, there are many ways to walk away from our discomfort. The Buddha taught that noticing our painful place is part of the work, but only part. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering, of dukkha, as we've been talking about the past couple of weeks. But it is not, I'm suffering and I want to end it. The insight of the noble truth is the acknowledgement that, yes, there is suffering. And I don't make it personal. So the first part of the task we all face in understanding the fundamental truth, the fundamental meaning of the First Noble Truth, that all is impermanent and all will perish. And that part's not too difficult, right? But the second part, to also see the impersonal character of suffering, that it is just part of our human condition. It's not just my suffering. It is something that we all share. I think that requires great courage and persistent practice. Now, the other kind of pull of our life around change is really fear of change, right? Either we want lots of change or we're kind of scared of it. And I think there is in each of us a voice that calls for the predictable, the safe, calls for what we're used to. And perhaps you've had friends who have always chosen the same kind of boyfriend or girlfriend, even though it never works out. I had a friend like that. Same kind of woman that he always would be attracted to, and it never worked. And you think, what's wrong with this guy? Or sometimes maybe we stay at the same boring or stressful job because it is predictable. And it's preferable to the uncertainty of the unknown. And I think, you know, in addition to this, there are times when we choose not to choose, risking nothing and hoping to avoid all consequences. But of course, there are always consequences. And then there are people at the other extreme. They choose everything. They choose everything out of a confused sense of greed, a kind of indulging in a gluttony, an effort not to miss out. And maybe they're caught in a deluded sense of control. If I choose everything, then I'm in control, right? I won't miss out. So in a way, kind of strangely, paradoxically perhaps, risking nothing and choosing everything are quite similar. Because, for example, if you're safe in isolation, right? I'm not gonna get in a relationship. I'm gonna stay in isolation. I'm safe here. Or you're juggling several relationships at once, choosing every one who comes your way. They both preclude any intimacy, any true intimacy from developing. Same result. We seek a solidity in life that we will never get through change and avoiding change, both, right? Through choosing change and avoiding change. If we're seeking that kind of solidity, security, no. We want a ground under our feet when there is only groundlessness. Knowing that everything changes, everything is impermanent, including these bodies, is helpful. But the deep source of our suffering is our resistance to the fundamental insecurity of our situation. I think the deep source of our suffering is our struggle against the essential ambiguity of this human life. We cannot control it. Groundlessness is perhaps simply another word for impermanence. But I think the word groundlessness, at least to me, also implies that we too are impermanent. That despite the kind of collective trance that we're all, that most of us are under most of the time, despite that trance, the experience of groundlessness tells us we are not outside the flow of change. You ever notice that? Like, I notice it sometimes when I, you know, meet friends that have had kids, right? And suddenly their kids are like at university. They change, but, you know, I don't. Resting in groundlessness can really open us to a refreshingly new possibilities. But for most of us, the sense of groundlessness in daily life is pretty darn frightening. For example, making a mistake, embarrassment, failure, having the rug suddenly yanked out from under our feet, pushes us out of our secure certainties. You know, like, I'm the competent one. I can do this. And suddenly, and we're left snatched out of what we have always thought, or at least sometimes feel to be our safe place, into a groundlessness, a sense of being untethered, which is another way of saying our stories that we have so long held on to are no longer there. They've been, at least for a few moments, short-circuited. And no longer certain ourselves, before long, our habitual stories and our habitual actions rise up to defend and place us back into certainty. And I see this in myself, you know. How do I respond to groundlessness? Sometimes with anger, sometimes with denial. Occasionally with laughter, which is, I think, a pretty good response. In the Buddhist tradition, these storylines that we have that put us back into a place of security are described as seeds in the unconsciousness. And these seeds are triggered when certain causes and conditions arise in our life. So when these conditions arise, these pre-existing propensities kind of pop up like weeds in the springtime, right? And when we again fall into the old stories about who we are and how we're going to react when something happens, when we do that, it is really to water and nurture the seeds again for the same propensities. Does that make sense?
Can you repeat the first part?
When we fall into the old stories, right, the old actions again, like we react to whatever has pushed us into groundlessness, it nurtures us to do it again. In a sense, we lay new seeds so that we're going to do it again the next time someone calls us an SOB, we're going to like ruffle our feathers, right? Arch our backs. Pema Chodron, the American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, describes our situation like this. And she wrote, the ego, our ego is like a room of your own, a room with a view, with the temperature and smells and music that you like. You want it your own way. You just like to have a little peace. You'd like to have a little happiness, you know. Just give me a break. But the more you think that way, the more you try to get life to come out that way, so that it will always suit you, the more your fear of other people and what's outside your room grows. So rather than becoming more relaxed, you start pulling down the shades, locking the door, and when you go out, you find the experience more and more disagreeable and unsettling. You become touchier, more fearful, more irritable than ever. The more you try to get your way, the less you feel at home. So I think what Pema Chodron illustrates here is our ego is trying to get a ground that is safe, predictable, familiar. My way. If I could sing, I would do that song, "I Did It My Way," you know. A room where we know where everything is and nobody comes in without our permission. Where the boat is never rocked. Sorry for mixing the metaphor there, but. And it's true, we all need some security and comfort. But the question is then, how do we leave this room and meet the uncontrollable nature of the world and the uncontrollable nature of your life? Rather than recognizing the groundlessness of our life, it's less fearful to hold on to the patterns and ideas of who we are. And these patterns and ideas that we hang on to, they're not really accurate or true, because most of them, or perhaps many of them, maybe most, come from TV, family, school, popular media of various kinds, about how life should be. And certainly TV dramas and a lot of the popular literature, I think, really reflect this truth to us over and over again, showing us images of people living lives that are not authentic, right? But recognizing our own patterns and ideas about what our life should be and letting them go is one of the most difficult, challenging tasks, in part because we believe that hanging on to those is the only reason why we fit in, the only reason that we're acceptable by others. Because if we showed our true self, which maybe we're not even quite sure what that is, we'd be lost. And so we make these patterns and ideas our identity. And maybe they were helpful in the past. But at the moment, in the present, they're like being tied up. I suspect that addictions, the various kinds of addictions, you know, that addictions are connected to our fear of groundlessness. In one way, you know, kind of drugs, gambling, compulsive sexual behavior free us, at least for a few moments, from our messy and uncontrollable life. And so for a few moments, we can rest in what feels like certainty. So here's our kind of conundrum. How can we grow up and meet the ever-changing world if we can't let go of what's no longer useful? How do we answer those kind of conservative voices, conservative stories within that demand a commitment to what is known and familiar and safe? How do we stop watering these seeds of old patterns and ideas? I think this is our task. So we need to practice. We need to make ourselves more amenable to living in the presence of change, in the presence of ambiguity. We need to practice remaining upright in the groundlessness of our life. And in a sense, that's what we're doing for all this practice period. Kate talked last Sunday on loss. What could be more groundless than loss? Change, kind of acquiring, change and loss is really the human story, isn't it? We acquire, things change, we lose them. So we lose part of ourselves, and we have to, as we demand, kind of adapt to the demands of this ever-changing world. Resilience is how we create the flexibility to embrace the uncertainty and groundlessness of this life instead of fighting it. So what do? Well, I think as we see in the First Noble Truth, we need to be aware of our suffering and how we react to it. The inclination to feel sorry for ourselves, the tendency to be jealous or our bent towards anger, those all too familiar emotional responses to our suffering are seeds that will just keep watering unless we become aware of them. So the practice is to notice the suffering and the urge to react, pause, and stay present with the underlying energy of the emotion, not giving life to the habitual reaction. But storylines, our stories that arise, have strong emotions. And those strong emotions are often associated with our feelings of certainty and comfort. Righteous anger, right? Gives me a pretty strong ground to stand on, for example. They bolster our solid sense of self, and they hold out a kind of false promise of safety and security. So when we notice these storylines beginning to play, we can interrupt them. Now, this practice period, one of the practices I've taken on is to notice when my self-critical voice gets loud. And then I say to myself, I return to my vow of kindness. I return to my vow of kindness. It's important to realize that interrupting the thoughts, those kind of reactive habitual thoughts, isn't the same as kind of pushing them away. Because denial of what's happening really only sends the thoughts briefly underground and then they return. But at the same time, you don't want the old stories to keep running, right? Like, you don't want to get entangled up in them again. So interrupting thoughts is a way of allowing the thoughts to come and go, kind of arise and pass away, but not engage in them. Right? I return to my vow of kindness. So another practice, I think, that's really strong is when that feeling of groundlessness arises, we can practice resting there for a few moments. And we can acknowledge that there's some fear, perhaps, unease and discomfort with groundlessness. But we don't have to distract ourselves. Instead, I suggest this, that we turn towards it and inquire, what freedom is present here? What has, or maybe, what is not fettered here? Now, learning not to be afraid of groundlessness, we learn not to be afraid of insecurity and uncertainty. Not afraid of insecurity and uncertainty, we become open and compassionate in any situation. I've noticed one way that I often fend off groundlessness is with my own opinions and convictions. Kind of aggressively stating and justifying opinions, I think we can kind of make our opinions into an absolute truth that needs to be defended at all costs. I'm right. And that gives a sense of solidity. So, the practice here may be to gently inquire and to discern what is it in oneself, in myself, that demands holding so strongly onto this opinion or into another opinion. In our Zen tradition, we value what's called don't know mind, a kind of spaciousness inside us that allows us to hold opinions much more loosely, making room for possibility. Don't know mind. This is most crucial in relationships. And so hard in relationships. Kate and I have been together for quite a few years. 35-ish. Yeah, 35-ish years. And you may think, I may think sometimes, I know Kate. But that's a big mistake. Please don't think that of your partner. It's much more truthful and loving to say, who is this now? Who is here now? But as the old Japanese saying goes, correct me if I'm wrong, fall down. Seven. Get up. Eight. Good. Fall down seven, get up eight. Right. To fully enter into this life, we must leave our comfortable rooms. Groundlessness, not knowing mind, impermanence, These are our allies. These will take us into the very mystery of being. And so we practice. And we gradually let go of our fear of these three and see them as they truly are. These will give us life. And I say I've talked already 5 minutes too long. So thank you very much for listening. And I'd like to give you folks a chance to talk a little bit with each other. And it's going to be interesting to see how we do this with this many people. What I'd like you to do, I'll give each person, I think we can still do 3 minutes, is to think about a little bit what I just said about change in your own relationship to change. Do you tend to grab on to change, or do you push it away to avoid this sense of groundlessness? What's an example in your own life that you notice? And for you, what would be a wholesome way to approach change? Is that pretty clear? Do you grab or push away change, fearful, or grab onto it, hoping for the next hit? Maybe an example from your life that you notice. And what would be for you a wholesome way to approach change? And if that feels too threatening or nothing comes to mind, talk about what you want. Connect it to the talk, please. Right? Just something that maybe you somewhat interesting for you. Hokey dokey? Okay. So what I'd like you to do now, please try to group yourselves into threes. Just grab a person, you know, near you. Cluster a little bit as best you can. We'll take a moment to get everyone organized. If someone could bring me the bell on a stick. And while you're getting organized, most of you know this already, but let me just explain the ground rules. Each person will get 3 minutes to talk. Other two people will simply listen. You don't even have to nod or, you know, make little listening sounds. Like, Just listen. Give your full attention to listening. And if you run out of things you want to say within the 3 minutes, just sit there for the rest of the time in silence. Unless something else arises that you would like to add, that's fine. And then I'll ring the bell at the end. We'll do a little bow to each other. And then the next person will go. And please don't crosstalk. Don't bring up what someone else has said. Just talk from your own experience as much as you feel you'd like to share. And once all three people have spoken, please don't bring up what someone else has said outside the circle here. So what's we say here really just stays here. Please don't mention it like in the back of tea or later. So we have a very safe place where people can share what they feel comfortable sharing. Ça va, ça va bien? We're okay?
If you're the speaker and you just come to a stop, then everybody in the group just sit there quietly, companionably. And you might think of something you want to add.
I mentioned this, Kate.
You did say that?
Yes. That's okay. You're forgiven.
Thank you.
Okay, so if you please say your names to each other now, just kind of introduce yourselves just briefly.
I'm Leo. I'm
Okay, I'm going to ring the bell, and then the brave person, jump in. 3 minutes. Enjoy.
So my first thought.
I guess I'm going back to trying to remember something that I've used in my life recently, and how I dealt with it.